Let's begin again. We feel that as Ron and I talked here after the last session, we felt that there was such a high interest in this particular area. I have a pile of questions that we have not gotten to yet. And so rather than going immediately into the area of the family and the ministry, that is the ministry that we have, that we would take the first portion of this session to continue with our question period. Then we'll ask Dr. Aldrich to, sometime in the middle portion of this seminar, to then share some things relating to ministry, and then you'll also have an opportunity for some questions in that particular area. So we'll continue at this point. We finished up our time somewhat in the area of teenagers, and perhaps we ought to continue a little bit with that. The feeling that one has when the teenagers are there is that you've blown it and it's too late. And so there were a couple of questions along the line is, when I have really blown it, perhaps you were not a Christian when the children were young. And now the children are up in teenage years, or maybe not even there yet, but you truly have been operating on bad principles. But now you want to start over and you want to start doing it right. Can you give some suggestions on how that can be done?
Well, they'll be purely suggestions, I'll guarantee you. I think it all goes back to the kind of person that God wants us to be. I'm impressed over and over and over again that the only thing that the Lord told us to copy Him in, or to be like Him, and remember, He said, "Learn of me, for I am meek and lowly." And that's so opposed to our modern 20th century mentality, plus opposed to the natural inclination of the human heart. But I really wonder if in situations where the parents are blowing it with their children, if they would go to the children in real love and humility, express to them how in the areas and the ways in which perhaps they failed, and try and reestablish some kind of a communication and understanding. And in essence, humble themselves. And rather than create an impasse where you're asserting and insisting upon your rights, surrender your rights. Because really, as Christians, we don't have any rights anyway. And give your expectations as far as your children are concerned to God. And then go to them and just with a real spirit of meekness. I think it would shock them. I think they would be speechless. They sensed it wasn't going to be another lecture, but rather it was going to be a real demonstration of love and concern and a confession and asking for forgiveness. I know that's a hard thing to do, and it's not something we see very often. I just can't help but feel that that would be valuable. I think another practical suggestion that has been tremendously helpful in our church is to get the kids to the Gothard Seminar. I think that's one of the greatest things you can do for your child. And I realize I just heard they're not in this area too often, but it'd be worth it for you if you've got a friend in a city where they're attending to ask them if you could send your kid for a week and let him go to it. Because the child or the teenager captures for the first time the fact that God's will is always directed through the parent. See, the child wants to develop a relationship with the Lord and somehow step out from under the chain of command. God says, no, there's no way. My will for you is revealed through your parents. Well, Bill really comes down on that. And I think it really gets through for the first time that they are, in essence, a diamond in the rough, and that God's tool for shaping their lives is the parent, saved or unsaved, Christian or non-Christian. God can communicate the basic principles that He wants to through someone who doesn't know the Lord. A parent intuitively senses what is right for his child. And in most cases, even a Christian or a person who doesn't know the Lord, in the basic areas of life, will desire the right things for his child. And that's why a teenager who has a parent who isn't a Christian has no right to try and step out from under their authority because they don't know the Lord. So I would sure suggest you can get some exposure to some of what Bill is saying too. Okay.
Relating to teenagers again, I have a question here relating to a teenager choosing his or her career. In many of our churches and in the Christian influences, there may be some careers that to many Christian parents would be maybe undesirable or at least lack opportunity for some teenagers. For instance, a couple that were mentioned here were, say, modeling and dramatics. Suppose the parent feels quite strongly opposed to the career direction of their teenager. What would you suggest doing in that context?
Well, I think, just to share my own opinion, I think dramatics would be a fantastic area for a Christian to go into. I think we have really sold ourselves short in the whole area of communication. And you read through the Old Testament and you see God's interest in art, music, the fact that when He designed the very place where His presence would exist, that He called in the greatest sculptures in the land and had them make bas-reliefs and images, that the great golden sea was supported by oxen that were examples of tremendous human skill, and that all through the Psalms we're enjoined to praise God with musical instruments. And I frankly feel a drama is one of the most effective ways of communicating if a child could see that this can be something that God can really use in his life. Our whole Easter service that just a couple of weeks ago was a drama that I wrote, or I actually, another person myself worked on, where we had a reporter going back and interviewing all the people in the days of Moses who didn't have blood on their doors. And it was one of the most effective, fantastic Easter services. We had people staying from the first service to the second service. We had people calling up who were there at the 9 o'clock service and called up their family and friends and told them, look, get down here for this 10 o'clock service. Don't miss it. It was a drama. No message. I didn't get up and preach at all. So I would want to be sure that the area couldn't be used to the honor and glory of God before I eliminated it. And I would suggest some creative alternatives. You know, if we often prohibit without providing. And if you're going to say no to something, well, let's have another suggestion. Maybe the ability that they seem to have could be channeled in another area, and maybe you could suggest that. And I don't think it would be legitimate at all or illegitimate at all for you to share your concern. I think it's all how you do it. I mean, if you see a kid who's obviously got talent or gifts in some area, but he seems to want to head a different direction, I don't think there's anything wrong with you sharing with him. I think the problem develops when you insist. You know, you say, well, look, you're not going that way. This is where you're going to go to school. This is what you're going to take. That type of thing. Because where you put pressure to stop something, you're creating a magnetic dynamic that draws them right into what you're trying to stop. And often the best way to keep a teenager from going a certain course is to not make a big issue of it. Express how you feel about it one or two times, and he doesn't need it every day. He knows how you feel. But if you make an issue out of it and continually nag and irritate, you're losing the battle, as far as I'm concerned. But I would suggest if this becomes a problem, you could talk to, if he has a good relationship with someone in the church, maybe suggest that the pastor sit down and talk with him and try and encourage him in some other area. But most of these kids are pretty lost anyway when they're teenagers. They really aren't sure what they want to do. I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do until I was in college. I think that's the usual situation. So don't expect them to have their future all mapped out, and don't get too shook up at the first thing they latch on to, because usually they can't see their own potential. I mean, if someone had told me I was going to go through 12 years of college and seminary training when I first started, I would have committed suicide. I was just thinking of going 3 years to Multnomah and, maybe going on after that a little bit. But I would have never seen myself up talking to a group of people on the family. It's been the last thing in the world for me to do. When I was in high school, I was student body officer and used to have to preside at all the meetings and so forth, and I was scared to death to even look people in the face, much less talk to them. So they will settle for limited objectives, and you should be encouraging them and believing in them. My mother always wanted me to be a surgeon. never forced, but this is what she thought. I had great hands for a surgeon. And so I always thought, well, maybe I'll go into medicine someday. But she did, this isn't what she had picked out for me, but she just said, well, Joe, you'd make a good surgeon. So I thought, well, gee, that's a live option. And didn't become a surgeon.
Joe, in relation to the things that you were talking about earlier, relation to TV, how would you extend that to the area, perhaps, of the theater and its effect on youth and adults? I suppose the theater could be divided into live dramatics and perhaps movies. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think that we fall into the trap of seeing life in blacks and whites. And life isn't that way. And I wish it sometimes were more black and white. But I think the important thing is to teach our children discrimination and discretion. For example, we would all eliminate Playboy magazine from magazines that would come into our house. At least I hope that we all would. So we tell our child, don't look at Playboy, but you subscribe to Life and Time. And you know as well as I do that Life and Time can have just as many sensuous type pictures and involvements as Playboy can practically. And I think the important thing, I would want to eliminate Playboy, yes, but I want to teach my child discrimination. I want him to learn that his mind is something that he needs to learn to control and that God wants to build into his life and into his thinking certain basic patterns of thought, and he wants to eliminate others. So that whether when he's in college and all the boys have their Playboy pictures up on the wall, which they do, they're wallpapered with them. I remember sitting there sharing the four spiritual laws. I didn't dare look up. Here was this big thing in front of me. And that happens all the time. So rather than teach him, don't look at Playboy, but he gets to college and he has all these temptations, I would rather have him come to the realization that, well, boy, my mind is something that my thoughts really need to be centered on that which is pure. And I think the same is true of the theater. We say, or some people do, don't attend the theater, but they'll sit home and watch the movies. You can watch a Dean Martin show. That can be just as sensuous and much more suggestive than a good Walt Disney movie. And if you want to say, well, you're contributing to the movie industry, when you buy from Safeway, you're contributing to the Mormons. They own it. So when you buy gas from a person who doesn't know the Lord, you're contributing to him. I think that's a fallacious argument. So I think there again it's a question of discrimination. And let me suggest something about liberty, Christian liberty. The legalist is the person who says, I can't. The person who understands this Christian liberty is the one who says, I won't. Tremendous difference. In other words, I may willingly limit what I do, but in the area of doubtful things, I have the right to do anything. I can go to the theater, I can go in a bar and have a drink of water. I have that right as a Christian, and I might even have a drink of wine, by the way. I have that liberty. And the moment I say I can't, I'm a legalist. I'm a weaker brother. But I can say I won't. I can choose not to exercise my liberty. And that's Christian maturity. So see, legalism is an attitude. And a lot of people think that to say I can't, if I say I can't to enough things, somehow I'm more spiritual. So I have my little list, my little dirty dozen, things I don't do. Well, I'd like to see us have a testimony in a community of the things that we do, that we stand for, the positive things that we believe. So I probably don't do all the things that the legalist doesn't do in most cases. Because the higher you go in leadership, the more you have to limit yourself. It's just a price you pay. And yet, nobody can tell me that I can't. I know that I have the freedom to do it if I want to, and I can do it with a clear conscience. But I willingly limit myself. And I think our kids need to see this. They see right through our phoniness. We take some other stand.
Joe, in relation to that, would you continue a little bit as to how much we should impose our standards in that sense upon our children, because obviously they have influences on them from various of their schoolmates and things that they want to do and that we may feel they ought not to be involved in. Now, how much should we impose our standards on our own children?
Well, let's stick to the area of doubtful things, because I think where things are obviously wrong, as long as the child is under our control, the control of our house, he has a responsibility to obey. I think in the area of doubtful things, if you have instructed your child and you build into them basic principles, then they have the same decision to make that you have to make about it. And if that child should decide that he or feels that he wants to get involved in something that you might have questions about, remember that probably you've walked with the Lord a lot longer than he has, and that God has done some pruning and surgery in your life that he hasn't got around to doing in that child's life yet. And I really wonder if we have the right to impose our level of spiritual maturity on our children. Now remember, I'm talking in the area of doubtful things, where Scripture doesn't say, thou shalt not, where Scripture is silent. You can express your preference that you would rather the child not, and you have a right to say you can't. And I think that you begin to allow the child to make the choice when he has won the right to make that choice. So, there is a sense in which we have a right to impose our will on them, but I think that as the child grows and matures, we also have the responsibility to let him make his own choice.
So would you say then that we go from a point of control to a point of counsel as a child matures?
Yes, in fact, the child moves from the chain of command to the chain of counsel as he wins that right. A thing that Bill Gothard develops in his program, but a child has to earn that right.
Good. Now, for very small children, we're leaving some of the older ones here for just a moment. How much freedom should you give them in terms of pulling pots and pans out the run of the house? How much should you restrict them? How much decision power should you give to them in the area of choice?
Well, I think we have to remember that children are not miniature adults. And I was talking to someone just before the session started about that very thing. For example, with my little boy, he's curious, he's growing, he's tremendously interested. I'm encouraging him to learn, to be investigate. So he does. Well, sometimes he likes to investigate my tape recorder. And we have gone around the house, and he pretty well understands what the no-nos are. And yet, sometimes his curiosity overcomes him. Sometimes I'm sure he forgets, because they have to be told over and over again. So if I catch him playing with my tape recorder, I don't discipline him at that moment. I don't discipline him for doing wrong at that point, because I'm not really sure at this juncture that he knows it's wrong. What I do, I tell him, look, Stephen, that's Daddy's toy. That's not for you to play with. Now, you shut the door and leave it alone. Now, if he does that, I drop it. But if he runs right back to it then and opens it up, then I have just, in the previous context, told him it's wrong. And so then I say, look, Stephen, Dad just told you not to do that, and if you don't quit, you're going to get spanked. So I've warned him in the immediate context. And then if he goes ahead and does it, he gets his little rear end blistered. But I think it's that we have to be careful that we're not overbearing in this thing. I mean, little Stephen can get frustrated. He runs to one no-no, and he's really interested. You know, the little knick-knacks we have out, we haven't put them up on the shelf. Well, we say no, and so he runs to something else he wants to look at. He's learning. He's learning five times faster than a graduate student. By the time he's 3 years of age, he'll know 50% of all he'll ever know. And the average 4-, 5-, 6-year-old asks 500 to 600 questions a day. Constantly probing, trying to learn. So I can't blame him if he runs to something else. That's just part of being a child. I can't expect him to be an adult. So I think if we can eliminate certain things that make life easier for mom, that's fine. But I have real problems with eliminating everything so that there are no no-nos that he knows about. But he ought to have some things that he can do. We finally capitulated and gave Stephen a drawer in this little sin corner that we now allow him to open and play in, simply because he always seemed to gravitate to that corner. And I hated to have to always be saying, no, Stephen. I didn't want him to So we finally decide, well, it's not going to hurt. We'll take the stuff out of the drawer and we'll just put some stuff in there that he can play with. And so now he can play in that drawer. It gave him a creative alternative. And I think that's important.
Perhaps moving for a moment to questions that some of the couples here may have who don't have any children or have very young children. When should a couple plan to have children? Some things maybe in the area of Planned Parenthood. How many children should one have?
Well, my mother and dad got married when they were 30 and had 9. I don't know. My wife and I were married 9 years almost before we had our first child. And we had a tremendous time together getting to know each other, getting to really understand each other and love each other before we had the children. And when Stephen came along, we were ready for him. We looked forward to him. We welcomed him into our home. And I feel that, boy, a couple of years without children at least is a tremendous time just to have the freedom of picking up on a weekend and going and getting to know each other and enjoy each other and so forth. I think probably it would depend on your age, obviously, somewhat. But if you're getting married in 23, 24 years of age, why not wait a couple of years? You'll be a better parent. You'll be better prepared for your child. Boy, I'd hate to think what Stephen would be like today if we'd had him right after we got married. And I think a lot of the reason that our family has been blessed to the extent that it has comes out of the fact that my parents were older and more mature. They weren't still going through trying to solve all their problems of adolescence. So I certainly suggest waiting. After all, the goal of marriage isn't parenthood. And wives, if you have a real strong urging to have children, I don't want to discourage you in that urge. But just be awfully careful that this somehow isn't more important than partnership. Be sure that in this desire for children, which is natural, that you don't allow this desire for children to overweigh and to supplant, when the children come, your responsibilities to partnership. Because then that's wrong.
Joe, since we've gotten back into the area a little bit of that partnership, in the husband-wife relationship, I have a couple questions here. One is, how can I still back up my wife, and I think, or husband, in a situation with a child when one is convinced that the other is absolutely wrong?
Well, that's a tough situation, and no doubt about it, because you do want to support each other. I think you obviously should talk it over with the wife, first of all. I mean, if the wife happens to be the one that you feel is absolutely wrong in this situation. And then I think in some situations, if the wife's, who may not be quite as logical and able to think through it with all the finesse of the husband, at least the husband doesn't think she can, there might even be a situation where if it's a teenage son or daughter, you know, you just kind of pull them alongside and say, look, we both fail as parents, mom and dad do sometimes, and mom had you do something here that we've talked about, and I've shared with mother that I'm, you know, your mom, that I'm really not sure that that's what I would have suggested. I think if you did this, you'd have to be sure that you backed up your wife and you said, in essence, I go along with what your mother did because she is your mother. But maybe it would just help the child understand that parents can sometimes fail and that there can even be disagreements between parents. But if you were to go to that child, I would be very, very careful that you didn't let the child think that you were, in essence, siding with them or that they could come to you expecting support whenever mom said something they didn't like. So it'd have to be something that you'd be very cautious in doing. Yeah, it might be a very helpful thing.
So in this same vein then, relating to the husband-wife relationship, could you give some examples of some areas that a wife should submit to her husband? And I think the impetus here was some practical things.
Well, that's a very interesting question because I think a lot of the problems over male leadership in the home come from a misunderstanding of what it means to be a male leader. See, we all have categories in mind that we think that a husband or a wife ought to be fulfilling if they're really going to be the male or the female play the male or female role. For instance, in the area of finances, there are many wives who feel that a husband isn't really being the spiritual leader in the home if he doesn't control the finances. Well, the Bible doesn't say anything about the husband controlling the finances. In my situation, I was brought up in a home where we didn't have money, where the paycheck never lasted more than 3 weeks of a month. We lived out of the missionary barrel. Most of the time, wore clothes with patches or holes in the soles of the shoes or something like that. Didn't have an allowance. Anytime I got a quarter or a nickel or a dime, it burned a hole in my pocket. I didn't write a check until I was married. I wouldn't have the foggiest idea how to write one if my wife hadn't showed me. She was brought up in a home where her parents gave her $5 or $6 a week. She had to buy all her clothes out of that. She had to take care of her recreation. This was back a few years. Couldn't do it now, I guess. But she really learned how to handle money, and she enjoyed doing it. And so, boy, it was no problem for me. I was delighted to have her take over this responsibility. And in my own family, my mother wrote the checks. I think if it became an issue where the woman was somehow using this power, because it is a power, in a sense, wrongly, boy, then the husband ought to put the lid on the thing. I would too. But why should the husband, if the wife is more capable and has a desire for it? And I shared this with a fellow in my office last week who's making an abominable mess of his finances. I said, have you ever thought of turning these over to your wife? Well, he was a little hesitant because he thought that in the process he would somehow be losing just a little bit of his headship. And I said, well, that's nonsense. Read the last chapter in Proverbs and look at the financial ability of that woman. Went out and bought a field, business transactions. And we have to be careful that we don't picture our own little concept of headship and have all these little categories that we're trying to force our husband into. I think to be the head isn't near as concerned with categories of function as it is attitudes between the husband and the wife. I don't think that the husband has to make all the decisions, and certainly the husband isn't right all the time. And there ought to be a good portion of the time when the husband recognizes that his wife is right and he says, you're right, dear. I think that's what we ought to do. But it's an attitude. It's recognizing that God holds the husband responsible for everything that happens in that household. God doesn't hold the husband responsible to do everything that takes place in that household. And a wife is to be a complement. That means she's to complement him in his weak places. And with every individual, that differs. And so how can we say exactly what a wife's role is and what a husband's role is? I think the Bible makes it clear, for instance, just to get into some specific areas, that the man's body is not his, it belongs to the wife. The wife's body is not hers, it belongs to the husband. There's an area of mutual submission where we can fail. I think that the wife has a responsibility to submit to the husband's plans for job, finances, the vocation that he takes up. She should fit in with his plans. I think that particularly if a person's in Christian service, full-time Christian service, that the wife has a responsibility to fit into the role that God is calling the husband into. I can't really conceive of the husband being called into something that the wife, who is really a spiritual person walking with the Lord, wouldn't somehow feel the same way. But I don't know. It's hard to get specific, to be truthful with you. In terms of roles, now maybe some of you can think of some specifics that you'd like to ask about, and I can give my opinion.
Are there any questions that you'd like to bring up in this area?
An interesting description, by the way, of the difference between a man and a woman that I think is instructive. Someone has said that a man seeks a cave with a grizzly bear in it, and he desires to drive out the grizzly bear. And a woman seeks a cave that she can turn into a home. And that's the difference between a man and a woman. A man has to have that life task or that life challenge, and I think the woman has to submit in that area. She can't decide that her husband ought to be a doctor when he wants to be something else. She can't decide that her husband ought to be in this business when he's really happy and he finds fulfillment in another area. That would be a clear area of submission, I would think. And yet the woman has a role and a rule, according to Titus, in the area of the home. that I think is an area where the husband has to be sensitive to her leadership.
One example that comes to my mind, Joe, is that there are many decisions that a woman simply does not want to make, nor should. Small mm-hmm. things, how involved she should be in various activities here and there. And a woman very often does not react as well to pressure as a man, mm-hmm. and it then becomes the man's responsibility not for her to submit to his decision, but for him to make certain decisions for her.
Okay, I understand that. That's a real good point. A woman is not made to bear a lot of the emotional type decisions that involve pressure and so forth in a marriage relationship. And many husbands cop out and really force the wife to make that decision that she isn't prepared emotionally and so forth to make. And that would be an area, a more specific area. Now, as far as listing some of these, you'd have to list these from your own experience because every one of you have different areas where probably you're sensitive in this area, where you feel the husband ought to be a man and make a decision, you know, not be a milquetoast. How many times have you heard that, husband? You know, get some backbone, make a decision. Well, that's true, and I think the wife just ought to let the thing ride until the husband makes the decision.
Good. I have a question here relating, again, to husband-wife relationships and discipline. A mother, I think I ought to read this one because I think it reads quite well. Must the mother who has disciplined and listened to the crying and yelling all day continue to do the discipline in the presence of her husband after he comes home simply to save his nerves and sanity?
No, I really don't think so. I think a child needs to see that the father is really the authority in the home. And I may eat my words someday. But just as I think the father in the whole area of sex education ought to take the initiative, because the male is by nature the initiator. I think that in this area he ought to convey the image that he is the authority and he is the one that God holds responsible. And I know I when I stay 2 hours with Stephen, I'm ready to give him back to Ruthie. I think a lot of us husbands need to have to spend a little more time with our kids than we'd appreciate what our wives have to do in a day's time. And I think we can, here again, this is living with them according to knowledge, with a realization that they've had a rough day. And of course the husbands have too, and they want a little relaxation and so forth. But I don't think the wife ought to take the whole load. Husbands, help them out. And because usually the child feels he can get away with a lot more of the mother than he can the dad anyway. And often if you will just put your foot down, you can set the whole course of an evening in a different direction. Because they will pick away and fritter and fuss at their mothers. And they know they can't get away with it with dad. Or let's hope they know that. They should.
Joe, in the relation to reading things to the children and to what they do read, Bible storybooks and so forth, one question related to a set of popular Bible storybooks put out by the Seventh-day Adventists. And the question was, are there some other books similar to this put out perhaps by an evangelical company or books that you would recommend to have in the home for the children to read that would be quite sound doctrinally?
There's a fairly new set that comes out. It costs $50. Expensive. But it's a 10-volume set. It's made just like the Encyclopedia Britannica. Beautifully put together. I wish I could tell you who puts it out. Big help. Southwestern... Oh, it's a group that goes around and sells Bible during the summer. Maybe some of you know about this. Who?
Southwestern Publishing Company, Nashville.
Okay, they are selling a set for the home, which I think is tremendous. It has beautiful graphics, which I think is important. You know, it's pictures, layout, design, and so forth. And at the end of each Bible story, they have usually 8 or 10 questions. And the first 2 or 3 questions are for the younger children. If you just have young children, you ask these couple of questions. But as you go down through the list, they get increasingly complex and difficult. So if you have teenagers in your home, the last 5 or 6 questions or 3 or 4 are right at their level. So you can adapt it right on the spot pretty well to the age group that you're involved with. And I think it's an excellent set. Ken Taylor has some good materials for children. If I'd known we got into this, I've got a whole bibliography. I don't have them as working capital, but I've got them on paper somewhere. A lot of good materials that are available. Yes?
What if they don't want to listen to Bible stories? They listen to anything
else. They just say, oh, I heard that story in Sunday school. How many times have I listened? Well, it's a good question. Any other questions? Yeah, this is something that I think is tremendously effective. Get a bunch of little kids and act out the crossing of the Red Sea and get some of them being the wind, you know, and blowing. And these kids, you know, there's a fine line between reality and fantasy with these little kids. And you can put them right in the spot, you know, and you bark like a dog and they're sure that, or growl like a lion and they can just hear the lion coming. It reminds me one time my little sister had a stool that belonged to me, and she was a pretty stout little gal and had herself wrapped all the way around it, and I couldn't pry her loose. So I figured that the best thing to do was to scare her loose. So I told her, Becky, I said, if you don't get off this stool, I'm going to start praying that God will send a bear. And so mother was watching all this take place. I don't remember it. And so Becky wasn't too scared at first, and so I knelt down on my knees and prayed. I said, Lord, please send a bear. And of course, I begin to dramatize the thing a little bit. I said, Becky, the bear's coming. I saw it run behind the barn. And Becky, you better get off my stool. It's getting closer. It's right over behind the garage, Becky. And Becky, it's going to come right around the corner of the house. And all of a sudden, I got scared and I dropped down on my knees. And I prayed, Lord, please don't send a bear. There's a fine line between reality and fantasy with these kids. And a puppet, for instance, can take a simple Bible story and just make it live. And you can try and tell the story to them and they won't even listen. But you get Tony the Tiger or somebody like that, and they will sit entranced as you work that puppet for them. Puppet's one of the greatest teaching tools for kids.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I think to get them involved, I know a dentist a doctor in Dallas who had a little study time with his kids every morning, and they were discussing the Book of Revelation one time in the city of Jerusalem with all the, you know, the foundations of gold and silver and all these jewels and so forth. So he said, look, just for a project, let's draw a picture of heaven. So these kids got out their Bibles and they read about all these jewels, and they worked for a week figuring out all the parts of heaven, and then they colored it and put it together. And these are just little kids. But it was a tremendously exciting thing for them. And it takes a little bit of creativity on your part. I mean, I can't blame them for being bored with a lot of what we give them, especially with our Sesame Street generation. That's what you're competing with.
Two books that have been useful in our family have been Ergermeyer's Bible Storybook. I think it sells for about $7. And the other one, if you want entertaining reading, which has interesting principles in it, is C.S. Lewis's Tales of Narnia.
Tremendous. Boy. And the thing is, as you read them, you will be entranced too. This guy is such a genius as a writer that it's the kind of a story that appeals to any age group. There's tremendous symbolism in these books. And as you read them, as an adult, you can see what's taking place. But the child is entranced too as you read the lion, the witch, and the wardrobe, and all these things are happening. And all the symbolism may go past him or some of it, but yet it's tremendously exciting. And I think there are a lot of books, like the Sugar Creek Gang books and some of these, that are Christian in their orientation. And they can be tremendously valuable for the kids. Or missionary biographies. Boy, get them the Bamboo Cross or some of these Jungle Doctor books. I don't know if they still publish those or not. We used to devour those things when we were kids. You ought to have this kind of literature around them all the time. Boy, spend money on books. It's really, really important. Yes. Well, that's a real problem, and I think it's a problem particularly as they get older if it is simply treated as a fairy tale. I think the important thing when you tell a story is to try and help them learn some principles of life from it. Like Jonah fleeing. He did something wrong, didn't he? That's right, he sure did. Did it affect anybody else? Yeah, the mariners, they were afraid and they had to throw everything overboard. They lost money, almost ruined their ship. So you see, you're saying to them, well, what do you think God is teaching us by including the incident of Jonah? And you're taking it out of the realm of a fairy tale and you're drawing principles out of it for them. Because if they see it simply as a story, then it fits right in with all the other stories they read.
Concordia Press has a very excellent series of storybooks with pictures. And the story rhymes all the way through. And they're really tremendous. We found these very good.
Concordia Press.
Concordia Press. Arch books.
Okay, I'm sure we could find those in the local bookstore. That's good. I know with Tales of Narnia, the rule in our home is they can't be read unless I'm there to listen because I don't want to miss a chapter.
By the way, Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress is a great one. I remember having that read to me as a kid, and I loved that. That was a great story.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's move on to a couple other areas. You've used the terminology that children need to earn their right to make their own decisions. How does a child earn his right?
Well, he does it by you're feeding a child responsibility, and you never feed responsibility without accountability. And as the child is responsible and also accountable, and he follows through, then he has won a certain status. He has come to another plateau. And you can give him then responsibility in that sphere, realizing that he may fail, and let him fail. Don't expect him to be perfect before you give him freedom. But if a child continues to show immaturity in a given area and irresponsibility, then he hasn't won the right at that point to have freedom in that area. He still needs to be subject to the whatever the rule or the category or whatever is set up. So it's meeting the responsibility which the freedom extends to him. Not always, but the majority of the time.
Joe, very often we have the problem of children not wanting to go to church. Now we make them go to school, whether they want to or not. Should we also make them go to church and Sunday school?
Well, I personally don't think it ever ought to be an issue. I know in my own situation, I'm sure I probably questioned whether we were going to go or not a few times. But to me, it was just an expected part of my experience. You know, we say that we don't want to influence our children. Well, why not? Television does. Your school teachers do. Every single teacher that teaches your child has a basic philosophy of life that he can't help but communicate, however objective he may try and be. His peers do. They exert a tremendous influence on him. And I think that we, in the area of religious concern, don't give our child a choice. We're not saying, look, here's a religious smorgasbord. Buddhism, Taoism, Shintoism, Seventh-day Adventism, Mormonism, all these things. You just go by and take your pick. I don't buy that. I'm not objective with my child as far as his religious experience is concerned. I'm very non-objective. Because I feel committed to the truth. I feel that this book contains the truth, and I'm thoroughly committed to it. And I want him to be the same way. Now, he's got to make his own decision. I can't force him to make that decision, but I'm sure going to make sure he gets exposed to it. Yes?
Doesn't that create a attitude? You were talking earlier about this 7 out of 8 teenagers don't show up church anymore. Is this created because of this?
It may be if this isn't a part of the child's life from the time he's very young. But see, with Stephen, he's never going to know a time when he wasn't in Sunday school. And I know I wasn't always excited in Sunday school, and I didn't care for a lot of my teachers and gave them fits. And I'm sure a lot of the time was wasted, but we went and ultimately profited from it. Yes.
Yeah.
I think that's true. And if there really seems to be feedback that the teacher is lousy and that, you know, some genuine legitimate problems, then you ought to go to the teacher. Now, I had a case just like this. A lady came up to me and she asked me, after a women's group I spoke to on Thursday, she said, "Joe, my boy doesn't want to go to Sunday school. Should I force him or shouldn't I?" And I said, "Well, what seems to be the problem? Has he been specific in saying why he doesn't want to go?" And he said, "Well, he doesn't know anybody, first of all. And, you know, he really doesn't seem to feel like he belongs." I said, "Well, why don't you go to the teacher and call the teacher and tell her this, share with her what the problem is, and I'm sure that the teacher is just totally unaware of it, and that the teacher could introduce him to the kids, make him feel at home, give him an experience of success, and with just a little effort, that whole situation could be turned around, and I think it will be." So maybe that's a good suggestion, because all behavior is caused. There's probably a reason why the kid doesn't like it, and maybe you can have a part in rectifying it, very, very simply.
Joe, one area that comes up quite frequently in families that have more than one child is quarrels between children. And not only perhaps between brothers and sisters, which is a major area of conflict, but also maybe between neighbors. But in particular in the family, how should the parents moderate these quarrels and how much should they let them go?
Well, it was declared war in our family between the fellows and girls most of the time. There were five girls and four boys. That's really a difficult question in the sense that how a parent should react, because you can't believe what the child runs to you and says in so many, many cases. You know, they describe it, and I can remember so many times it used to irk me because my older sister would usually kind of be in charge when the folks would leave, and I'll have to admit I was never innocent in some of the altercations that we'd get involved in, but they came through awful one-sided sometimes, and I sensed that in many cases, because of the reputation I'd already established, that I got the short end of the deal sometimes in my parents' response. And yet I don't know how you can help but do that in some cases. I think you have to listen to the situation. Try and ferret out, blame if you possibly can, find out what happened, and then act to the best of your knowledge with the willingness, if the situation turns out to be different than you thought, to go back and admit that you were wrong and ask forgiveness. You know, we need the wisdom of Solomon, which we don't have. And yet I think we have to claim that promise that Paul suggested to Timothy, that God has not given us a spirit of fear or of incompetence. And parents need to know that and be convinced of it, but of competence and compassion. And in 99% of the times, the parent basically knows what the right thing is to do. But our modern psychology books and a lot of these other things have got the parents running around half scared to death. And I think it's really pathetic from that standpoint.
Question.
If the kids are just arguing and they haven't asked for your help, they're debating about, I don't want to play this game with you right now.
Well, I don't think, you know, unless the thing really escalates in the major warfare, that the little normal give and take between kids ought to be something you ought to be jumping into all the time. I don't know. I'm not speaking from my own experience here as a parent, so it's tough because I haven't. I can reflect on my childhood and see some of the inequities that I sensed at times. But it's kind of tough for me to really say as a parent. Maybe some of you who have more than one can help out better here.
Well, maybe we might be better off to move into just a couple last questions. One is, children within even the same family differ quite a bit on how readily they tell the truth. And I'm sure many parents, I know myself included, have experienced lying in various instances by the children to one extent or another. Some have a great propensity to do that. If telling a lie will keep them out of a little bit of Dutch, there seems to be no conscience about it. Can you give some hints on how we might help our children get over this habit?
I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll give you some illustrations from my own life of how my parents didn't solve the problem. I was always a good liar. I could remember so well, Dad had a little safe there at home, and he used to keep Walnettos in it. I don't know if you've ever eaten Walnettos, but they're little candy things. And I found out where the key was. So I used to get into this thing all the time, and I had the ability to look a guy right square in the face and tell him a straight lie. I can remember Dad always wondering how these things were disappearing, and he'd go around the family and ask, well, did you take them? No. And he'd come to me, did you take them? No, Dad, I sure haven't been in them. And I'm not sure that you can solve the problem. I think that often the reason that a child gets in this kind of a situation is because when he does tell the truth, when he is honest, the consequences are pretty severe. And I personally feel, and I, here again, I'm not speaking from experience with Stephen yet, but it seems to me that if you encourage the child to be honest and open, and there seems to be an alleviation of deserved penalty if he is open and honest, that maybe you would be encouraging him to move in this direction. I don't know. It's a difficult problem to determine how you're going to keep a child from lying because he's a liar by nature. Isn't that what John 8 says? That your father is a liar from the beginning, referring to a child who doesn't know the Lord yet, or any individual who hasn't committed his life to Christ, that his allegiance then is to Satan himself, and that Satan is a liar and the father of lies. So this is part of our human nature. It's part of sin. And maybe some of you have some suggestions how you've helped in this area that would be helpful to me. What have some of you done?
Find them out.
Well, yes, I think if you find them out, but that didn't seem to be the question. It seemed to be to help a child keep from lying originally, wasn't it?
Well, that and continually doing it. I know there are children who are punished for lying. Mm-hmm. And yet seem to keep on doing it. It's punishment has not seemed to work, though that is certainly the first. I know with our children, the first time it's found out that a direct lie has been told, there's a meeting of minds and other places.
Well, I think something that's important that I haven't mentioned up to this point, I think when you discipline a child, that the child ought to see that what he has done has grieved you. And that adds another element to discipline. And I think you ought to express this grief and let him know that he has grieved you. And maybe that would add another dimension to simply physical chastening in terms of lying. If the child senses that not only is this wrong because he shouldn't lie, but it's wrong because he's hurt someone that loves him. And there again, you can go overboard on that to the extreme.
Bob Duddy?
That's a good observation, Bob. You're programming your child. I like the concept of psycho-cybernetics very well in the sense that it's telling us that if we read garbage, we're going to live garbage lives. And if we want to cut out certain behavioral patterns in our lives, then God has given us the Word of God as a surgical tool. And I really feel that we can head off a lot of problems in the lives of our kids by anticipating some of the developmental tasks that they're going to go through and some of the problems they're going to face, and preparing them for it by getting them into the Word and memorizing, particularly when they're young and they can memorize so easily. That's a good suggestion. Yes. And it's very important that you don't put your kid in a category that he can never get out of. And this is somewhat of a category that I was in, deservedly, because I was kind of a black sheep, but I wasn't always a black sheep. And as a result, I was sometimes really misunderstood. And it's very easy even to communicate that to the child. You know, you're a liar. He hears this often enough, and he begins to believe, well, boy, I really am a liar, and I guess that's kind of what the only thing I'll ever be is a liar. And we have to be careful in this regard. Yes? Well, this is just a suggestion. I'll throw it open to some of you. I always think it's good to encourage positive qualities as much as you can. And if you're sensitive to it, that's half the battle. Don't allow yourself to categorize them or whoever is involved in a situation like this. I would bring something like this personally if it had gotten to the point where it was a problem at school, to the attention of the teacher. Because the teacher can determine in a large measure, or to some measure anyway, the reactions and attitudes of the kids, and can really be an influence in trying to change the image of that child in terms of the classroom. And that's a sad thing in school, is that a kid gets the image of, as a B student, and it's passed on from teacher to teacher. And if you're a B student, friend, it's pretty difficult to break into the A bracket. But once you get it established in your mind that you're an A student, you can do B work and still get A's. And this is the problem of categories. We're suffering from hardening of the categories.
Joe, I have one very brief question, and then I want to close off with asking one that I think will be very important to the people here that was brought up. The brief one is, how do you love your neighbor and at the same time separate your children from playing with them because of their behavior, the influence of peers on your children that you feel is undesirable?
What was that last question you had? Well, what does it really mean to love? You'd have to get back to that. And you'd have to think through the priorities of love. Who is my main responsibility to? If to love my children is to seek their highest good, then maybe there are some areas they're going to have to be separated from. But to really love your neighbor, it may have to be purely on an adult level, where your association would be at that point. I would sure want to know what the objectionable behavior is before I would come to the decision that I would reject playing with them. And there's certainly plenty of situations where that should be done. I'm not questioning the question, but if it were my own situation, I realize the children are children and that there are going to be certain things that are going to happen that we just can't shield them from. And if we're doing a job of building into their lives certain qualities, maybe we have to take that risk to a certain degree. Yes?
Mm-hmm.
Well, It would mean coming to a decision between the husband and the wife as to the kinds of things that they were going to allow in exposure. As far as language is concerned, if they don't get it from their playmates, they're going to get it somewhere else. I'm not in any way condoning the language. I rebel a little bit against the greenhouse approach with raising children. There again, it goes back to trusting the Spirit of God to honor your commitment as parents to their growth. Now, I realize you can't go to the other extreme. You have a responsibility to protect. That's part of love. And so it's a very difficult thing to answer. I am so committed to reaching my neighbor and building relationships to them. And the Lord, we've seen the Lord bless so much in this way of opening up our home that I'm hesitating and resisting shutting the door, even though there may be behavior that is objectionable. I would want to know what that behavior is. Ron?
Did you develop what you did at our staff conference on the identity of your family? The Aldridge family doesn't do certain things. Does that fit here?
Yeah, that might at that. My folks always build into us the fact that the Aldriches were special, number one. And they always told us that it was a privilege to be an Aldrich. And we felt that it was a privilege, maybe more than we should have. And as a result of this, they would tell us continually that, sure, there were things that our neighbor kids did and that kids that we played with did that they didn't agree with. But because we were Aldriches, we had to expect to meet higher standards. Not only because we were Aldriches, but because we were Christians. And that there were certain things that the Aldriches didn't do that maybe some of the neighbor kids did. But I think, having been with some of the neighbor kids and gotten involved in some of the things that we did together, I know that there were some things that went on that weren't always right. And yet, in the long run, our family had a tremendous influence on a lot of these neighbor kids. Some of us kids led some of them to the Lord ourselves. And so maybe part of the answer is challenging these kids in terms of a ministry. When I was in the fourth grade, I used to, every week in a public school, take about 20 kids for 20 minutes or a half hour and teach them. Teacher would let me go back in the back part of the room, and many of these kids trusted the Lord. Now, I was as a fourth grader. Why? Because someone challenged me. And maybe if we can help our children see their playmates not only as buddies, but as opportunities for ministry, they will really take it seriously. And it'll help them understand. I think children have a lot more wisdom than we give them credit for. However, if there's obviously things that involve immorality, this type of thing, then it's got to be dealt with. And probably the parents, the neighbors next door would appreciate you letting them know about some of these things if you have insight into what's going on. Because I don't know too many parents who really want their kids involved in things that are immoral or this type of thing. You have to be careful in how you dealt with it. But maybe that would be a real act of love, just to share it with them. Share your concern.
Joe, let's just close off with this one last area, at least this portion of the discussion. One of the only times during a day that the entire family is together is often the dinner meal in the evening. And could you give any ideas as to things we should do at that meal to make it a good time with the family, and some things that we should not do?
Now, my first suggestion would be to eliminate the malice at mealtime. A mealtime should be a happy time together. It should never be a time when you bring up wrongs that took place during the day. As much as possible, it shouldn't be a time when you're getting after your children. I read recently among teenagers that, I believe I'm correct, and maybe some of you read it too, that 3 out of 12 teenagers, only 3 out of 12 teenagers are home eating the evening meal at least 3 times a week. I believe that's right in terms of the statistics. And yet a study was done at Harvard University to discover the most influential thing or event or activity in the life of a child. And it was very interesting that the thing that influenced the life and the direction of a child more than anything else was what the father said at the dinner table. It's the greatest time in the world for teaching. And that was a hilarious time when we were kids. I remember we had a little pet duck that we used to put in the middle of the table. Shouldn't tell you this. We had a little dish there that had flowers growing, and this dumb little duck would swim around, and he'd run over to your peaches, and he'd get a bite of peaches, and he'd run on all over the place. And mother's sitting there just coming completely unglued. Willard, you know, you shouldn't let him do that. But we thoroughly enjoyed our meal times together. Except when I told my grandmother that I must eat. But it ought to be a time of fun. I think you ought not to take yourself too seriously. I can remember many times in the middle of prayer somebody would say something, we'd all break down and just crack up. And Dad would say, well, I guess we just better quit for tonight. Or if we're reading in the scripture or a Bible story and somebody said something funny, that's no time to come unglued and, you know, you ungrateful reprobate. You know, we're reading the Bible. What's the matter with you? Good night. Be a human being. It ought to really be a good time. And I have real problems, by the way, with a lot of the things that take our kids away from our homes. It seems to me that parents just become chauffeurs. And I realize it's good for a kid to be involved in athletics, and he can learn personal discipline, and it's good for them to be in Brownies and Girl Scouts and a million other things. But I really wonder in the long run if it's in the best interest of the child to have them out and being run around all the time. I think they ought to be home, particularly for dinner meals, as much as possible. It's such a formative time in their experience.
Thanks, Joe. One comment?
I wonder if you would comment briefly on family devotions. Usually they're not a Keswick conference. types of problems.
Well, in our situation, in our family, they're always just very, very simple. We use daily light most of the time, and in the morning, none of us would think of leaving the table. We weren't allowed to until we had read in daily light and we had a word of prayer after the meal. We prayed before, and then Dad would read about 5 minutes. We have a word of prayer. The evening meal, we usually took more time after the meal was finished and we'd had dessert or whatever. Dad would either get out the Bible or daily light and read. And it wasn't anything too profound, or even then it wasn't too creative. My dad is not a real creative person, other than having children. But I think the important thing was the consistency. The fact that I never knew a day in my life when this didn't happen. I go home now, still the same thing, faithful as clockwork. But even greater than the consistency of doing it at the table is the fact that I could go home tonight, and when I'd wake up in the morning and go downstairs, there'd Dad be sitting reading his Bible in front of the fireplace. Every single day, never misses. And I see him doing that. Well, if all the child is getting, if you're just easing your conscience by reading the Word at the table, you never read it yourself, well, your child's not going to appreciate it. And I know a lot of times it just went through one ear and out the other. But as Dad used to say, you can pour water through a sieve and it won't collect too much, but the sieve will get cleaner in the process. And that's true.
Well, I think at this point we'll cut off the discussion on children. I still have about 15 or so questions here, but I think many of them have been answered in part in the progress of our discussion. So let's stand up and take a little stretch break. Maybe we can open the windows.